Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, oh, hey, nah, 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 hey, nah.
Welcome to Human Design on Air. I'm your host, Peter Rowe, from loveyourhumandesign.com. And today we're going to be talking about the incarnation cross of the four ways and the four I Ching gates associated with that incarnation cross. And to help me do that, I'd like to introduce the Reverend Rick of RevRick.webs.com. That's Rick, R-I-C. Reverend Rick, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Peter. It's a pleasure to be returning today.
And Reverend Rick is alluding to one of the gates. I think it probably, again, we're talking about human design and we're talking about the gates in human design. These come from the Chinese I Ching, and gate 24 is one of the gates in the incarnation cross of the four ways, called returning, and it's a very mental gate. And if you have gate 24 in your chart, you are most likely designed to ponder things over and over again, and that can be a beautiful thing, because it can ultimately produce a polished product, a polished idea, a polished piece of knowledge. But it can be a struggle at times if you get stuck in that mode. So that is the returning joke by my co-host. Reverend Rick, any items that you want to talk about before we dive into this discussion of the four ways?
No, I think I am pretty much at ease.
Pretty much. That's good. Well, as we get ready to dive into this four-way discussion, just wanted to point out we do have a blog post. It was a little bit late. I just got it out there a few minutes ago, but it is out on loveyourhumandesign.com. And if you click on Peter's blog on the tab on the right-hand side and look for the article Incarnation Cross of the Four Ways, there's some data on these four charts and a little description about the Cross of the Four Ways. And there are two celebrity charts out there that we're going to draw into the discussion. One is Oprah Winfrey, the famous talk show host and magazine entrepreneur and various other enterprises, and the comedian Jerry Seinfeld. And those two people were both born under the incarnation cross of four ways. Before we get more specific about the four ways, Reverend Rick, I'd like to hear your sort of general take on what does it mean, what does incarnation cross mean to you, and what do you think it should, that people should think about when they look at their incarnation cross?
You know, for me, the term incarnation cross has a synonymous phrase. So for me personally, I hear incarnation cross, and my mind interprets that as reason for being. And, you know, our reason for being in these physical bodies, our reasons for being incarnate at this time in this particular place, you know, meaning Earth. And I guess what I take from that I try to share with all of my clients and the people that I do readings for, is to help them understand there are certain energies that point us in the right directions, if you will, throughout our lives. And those lead energies, those guiding energies, if you will, form the basis of how we are perceived and how we perceive, how we interact and how others interact with us. And so in that sense, our incarnation cross is made up of those lead gates that have so much influence in our day-to-day activities and essentially provide our reason for being, quote-unquote. And so for me, that's what incarnation cross means.
Well, thank you. There were a few nuggets in there that I grasped onto, and the last one is sort of picturing it like a compass. And not necessarily focused on, this is a compass with four points, and not necessarily in terms of how we look at a compass in that a lot of times when you look at a compass, the focus is which way is north. It's mono-focused, I guess I would say.
Uh-huh.
But the purpose of the compass is orienting yourself. And so I just got this imagery that this is a four-way compass, and I guess it's particularly appropriate since we are talking about the cross of the four ways, that it's really a four-way compass with four points, and for you it's the orientation of those four points, whether you're the four ways or a different cross, and for others it's basically the way they see you orient, or it's their perception of the orientation of those four points.
That's right, because as you and I have said many times before, human design is really a tool that helps us see things from both perspectives. It's never just about us. It's about us and our interactions with others.
Yes, it is. And so when I first started learning a little bit about the incarnation across the four ways, I really felt that there's multi directions here. I mean, in one sense, I guess a simple analogy would be the four-way stop that many of us are familiar with. Maybe in Europe it might be more of a rotary, but here within the United States, we have a lot of intersections that are four-way stops, and traffic is coming from four directions. And the four ways really, as we go into these gates that we're going to talk about, for me, they really go in many directions. In writing the post for today, I relied heavily on the incarnation, the Global Incarnation Index book that was put out by Jovian Archive and Ra Ruhu. And that really deals with the four ways as four approaches or four ways that humanity and humankind is driven forward in a somewhat of an evolutionary viewpoint. But when I first encountered the four ways, for me, there was also some significance in the four planes of existence, that it really felt like each of these four gates has a root or a foot in a different plane. And those planes are mental, emotional, physical, and spiritual. That all four energies are represented here in this one cross. And that's somewhat unique. As we looked at last week, we had the cross of laws. Well, two of the four gates were in one channel. So they were, more rooted in a particular center. And we've done shows on the vessel of love and the incarnation cross of the Sphinx. And all of those gates for both of those crosses are rooted in the identity center. So I'd say this is less the norm that there is such a diversity of energies among the gates in terms of the planes, possibly in terms of, as Ra describes it, the ways or the directions that we're being pushed to evolve. Reverend Rick, your thoughts on the four ways?
Well, as you were describing all that, I was thinking, you know, the cross of the four ways could almost be renamed in light of what you were just saying, the cross of the four interactions, or, you know, the four ways in which people interact, or the cross of the four movements. Because, again, it's about how we, both individually and collective, I should say, how we move, how we, you know, how we live our lives and how we find ourselves interacting with the movements of other people's lives. And it truly is, as we get into the discussions, we'll find that these four gates, their energies are all tied to the other. None of these gates have energies that are in and of themselves independent. You know, they are all tied in some way, shape, or form to an other. Even gate 24, the mental gate. You know, you think of mental energy as being a very unique and individual energy, and although gate 24 is a unique and individual gate, you know, being part of the individual circuitry, it is still an energy that involves others, and we'll get to that more as we talk about it more. But it was just interesting to me that those things came up. You know, this could easily be the four ways of interaction or the four movements of a being.
And I like that point you made there, because in other shows we've talked about the different types of energy. The three types of energy, specifically the individual, the tribal, and the collective. And in a way, I think as we discuss these, you're going to see that these gates try to integrate those three energies. We often talk about how you can't separate the pieces of human design in a vacuum, because they are interdependent. And I think this is one of the crosses that really gets into integrating individual energy, tribal energy, and collective energy together, or at times to evolve, really. I mean, I think it does go back, as Ra was saying, to evolution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and as he points out, it may not be overnight evolution. You may have a mutation that happens overnight, or happens from the birth of a, you know, the classic one, I guess, that stands out in my scientific learning. Was the mutation of white moths to black moths that happened in England and parts of Europe in the 1800s. And if you don't know this story, white moths were the predominant moth, but there were a few mutated brown or darker moths that were born to the white moths, and because there was such heavy use of coal in England in that time period, the blacker moths survived better because they blended in with the coal dust that was on a lot of the surfaces, and the white moths were easier to find for the white moths stood out for the birds and things that would consume them. And so that evolution was perhaps overnight with the black moth being born, but the transition for them being dominant took years and years.
Yeah,
but I guess
did.
I digress a little bit.
I was going to say, I always find that as I always find that story rather fascinating because that's one of the fastest adaptation type of mutations to be recorded.
Yeah.
So, just interesting.
Yes, and some are fast. Some evolution things are fast, and that was one of the faster ones, which is probably why it's taught. And some take hundreds and hundreds of... Well, I think if you look at religion, for the most part, a lot of the modern religion sprung up a couple thousand years ago, and for a lot of people, there, I'd say there hasn't been a lot of evolution in that in 2,000 years, or at least 1,600 years. And I think we're beginning to see in the last maybe 30 years that some things are going on, but they certainly haven't, if you did a worldwide poll of what religions people follow, it hasn't been a huge change. Percentage-wise.
Yet there's a lot of changes in the air.
There is. And it'll be interesting to see where it goes and how fast that comes.
Great.
But so let's get back into the four ways. And Reverend Rick, do you want to talk more in general, or should we jump right down into some of the gates here?
Actually, if you don't mind, I'd like to jump into the gates, but more so because I'm fascinated by Oprah Winfrey's chart, so I wanted to talk about gate 19 from the perspective of Oprah Winfrey.
Well, then let's do that.
I think anyone who knows anything about Oprah Winfrey, and she's certainly such a public figure that it's hard not to know who she is. But if you're lucky enough to see an interview, a candid interview with her and maybe some behind-the-scenes kinds of looks, you begin to realize that she is a deeply, deeply caring individual. A lot of her motivation stems from how deeply she cares about other people, about society, about what's right. I was quite impressed when I actually saw a little behind-the-scenes type of interview with her. And it's no wonder now when I look at her chart that she is that way. She has in her her first gate in the personality side, if you're looking at the chart, that's at the very, very top of the column of black numbers, that is on both sides of that circle with the dot. That circle with the dot represents the sun, and the sun is activating two gates, one in the red column, one in the black, and the one in the black column is the 19. And 19 is a very interesting gate. It actually has a lot of different qualities to it. It's part of the ego circuit, which automatically makes people think in terms of the mundane and the materialistic nature of the world we live in and all that. But at the same time, it carries with it a very profound spiritual element or spiritual overtone to it as well. And it's an energy of being very sensitive. It's an energy of being sensitive to all kinds of things. It's being sensitive to your own needs. It's being sensitive to the plight of others. It's being sensitive to the fact, to the point that you can tell when your clothes have been washed in a different detergent because they feel differently on your skin. That's a lot of mundane type of stuff, but at the same time, this is also a sensitivity that leads to the formulation of communities. It's the drive to be a part of a community, to support that community, to be supported by that community. It's about having all of those needs met that we as a social being need to have met. It's not just food, water, and shelter. It's about community interaction, communication, closeness, you know, all of that. And so this gate has two names. In human design, we call it the gate of wanting or sensitivity. And from the I Ching, as Peter said, where all these 64 gates come from, it's known as the energy of approach. So this is the movement, if you will, for this gate, is the movement of approaching others, approaching an opportunity, approaching a project. It's the opportunity of, it's the energy of moving towards something in order to establish some form of interaction that hopefully will be beneficial and meet the needs that we have. Peter, anything else you want to add to that?
Well, I'll just add some from Ra, and Ra talks it about again as that approach. And Ra goes into approaching the future, and that this is a spiritual gate. And in addition, there's a real because it's approaching others, it's looking at how we are dealing on a physical level with things in our world, specifically food, and feeding everyone and providing food for everyone, or not. And, you know, there are certainly parts of the world where we're not doing very well as a race. And so Ra talks about his view is that this needs to change, that us specifically using animals and meat needs to change because it's a very inefficient use of our resources. As you may know, raising meat requires vast amounts of water, land, and all the resources, and it's not necessarily sustainable for 7 billion people that we have now on our way towards 10 or more billion people. And so that this gate, the energy of this gate, is going to need to change our approach to that. And again, this is one of those, it may not be overnight, it may take several hundred years for that to change, but that's how it's looking now, anyway.
Yep.
And
go ahead.
Well, and he also ties in a spiritual aspect that with that the animals became a big part of the spiritual aspect. You know, they were used for sacrifice. And, you know, now that's really not done very much anymore, at least in the overall population. But they are, you know, they are used for our food, which is a form of sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this spiritual change that will need to happen as well.
Yep. And as far as another aspect of that, Gate 19 is actually part of what we know as three mystical channels. You know, again, that mystical referring to more of that spiritual nature, spiritual aspect to it. There's some kind of spirituality foundational in this energy, even though it's part of the ego circuitry, and we may feel this energy on a more mundane level, it does have that spiritual tie to it. And as you were saying, Peter, we need to start paying a little more attention to that kind of energy. We need to really start looking at it more because, as you said, you know, it's not just approaching others to form community. It's the viability of the community over time. So it is an approach to the future and what can be done to guarantee survival in that future. And part of that is looking at the resources. And, of course, that is a very tribal element of this energy. So, yeah. So after approach, where do we go next?
I think we should go to returning.
Okay.
And so again, returning. This is gate 24. And you know, this is reincarnation. This is returning. Ra talks about this evolution that we do. And you know, we physically, if you believe in this, we physically return to body over and over again. Many of the lessons, many of the changes that humankind experiences take centuries to happen. I think we're in a unique situation because we have seen so much change with the Industrial Revolution in the last 100 years that we have a perspective of completion of change, whereas generations and generations before that didn't have such a drastic window in their lifetimes. And so not saying that because of that we've seen everything change, but I think we do have a different perspective. But this gate 24 is all about the returning, because without returning, we only have a little glimpse of the picture. You know, and I think if you look at that from a spiritual standpoint, life's too short to experience everything. I'm sure a lot of us have things on our list that we probably won't get to this time around. And that's sort of the essence of this gate. Is there will be an opportunity to return and see where this is all going, or see, add more diversity to our experiences to fill out that what we're missing. Reverend Rick, your thoughts on 24.
I would probably add only one more element to that, and that is that, you know, the because it is up in the mental areas, up in the it's in the ajna, which is all about processing mental energy. Returning also refers to mulling things over and over and over again in your head. This is returning to the same thoughts over and over again, but not without, you know, not just as a futile exercise. This is an energy that says, go back over these things, think about them until you can make some kind of sense out of them that you can share with others. And basically it means when you get to that moment of clarity, that aha moment that inevitably comes in, you know, then you've processed it enough and you can actually share that information with others. And ultimately from the mental energy standpoint, that's what you're designed to do. You know, if you've got this gate, you're designed to reach that moment of clarity so that you know and understand how to present this mental imagery or this mental thought or this mental process, whatever it is. But you get to the point where you can then present it to others. And that's why I was saying even gate 24 has an element that has to do with people outside of yourself. So all of these really are about interactions one way or another. You know, you're sharing your knowledge, your wisdom, your insights, but only after a period of time where you've been able to go over them and figure out for yourself how to say them, how to present them, how to share them. And then with any luck, they'll be heard by people that need to hear them and have the impact that they're designed and meant to have.
And to tie that in to what I was saying, that mental processing, well, if you've only seen half the movie, you might not be able to do that. And so it might require returning to
exactly.
another lifetime or returning to another perspective.
Exactly. And you know, Peter, you and I have said many times, it's all energy. So how do we know you don't bring that same wisdom and knowledge back with you every time you return? And you know, it might take a few decades to figure out how to access it, but you know what? It's probably all still there.
Yep. So which way do you want to do next?
I think I will go with coming to meet. And coming to meet would be gate 44. And if you're looking at Oprah Winfrey's chart on Peter's blog page, then this is the circle that is over towards the left-hand side of the graphic above a brown triangle. And it's a black and red checkered channel that is going diagonally up from left to right. So it's coming off the spleen. It's gate 44. We call it the gate of alertness. It's also part of the ego circuit, just like gate 19. So it is, again, partly, it is, again, tribal energy. So it is concerned with the survivability of the community, of the tribe. But it's also about an alertness to patterns, an alertness to patterns of the past, I'll put it that way. This is associated very closely with cellular memory. This is not memory that we recall mentally. Remember, the spleen is all about physical awareness, you know, physical well-being. So this is a cellular memory that's you know, housed so deeply in our own being that it's not something that we can conjure up mentally. But it is an alertness that, you know, along with that intuition that tells, you know, the hairs on the back of the neck standing up at some point, you know, this is an alertness to patterns that says, whoa, wait a minute, I've been through something like this before. But it's also called coming to meet because it's all about being able to acquire the resources that the tribe needs. You know, this is all about coming together with others and sharing and knowing, you know, knowing what to do. You know, this is the intuitive awareness that any successful interaction, okay, with someone else in terms of being able to acquire what you need for your tribe to survive necessarily involves the letting go of preconditions. You know, if you're actually, and again, I like to think that this has some kind of spiritual component to it as well, in terms of, you know, if you're really going to seek what's best for the tribe, if you're really going to quote unquote the marketplace to deal with others and to trade and to try to get the things that your tribe needs, that your society needs, then you know, you kind of necessarily need to go in with an open mind. You know what you want, you know what you need, and you know what you're willing to give up for it. You know, you know what you're willing to trade for it. But you can't really go there with the idea that I'm going to do this, this, and this, and nothing else. Because the interaction necessarily means a give and a take. And when we realize that, when we know, you know, when we understand that coming to meet means there's going to be an equitable exchange, then we need to be open to what form that equitable exchange can take. And that's what I would consider to be part of the spiritual element to this tribal energy. Peter, you wanna add anything else to that?
Well, there's a real aspect to this energy that is looking backward and looking forward. Or, well, actually, I don't know if looking forward is might be oversaying it, but it's looking backward in the moment. And it's looking at what we may have experienced. There's the potential that it's fear-based. And, you know, in terms of, I think three out of these four gates have to do with provisions, and more specifically with food.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not so sure the 24 up in the Ajna really has anything to do with food. It could, if that's what you're pondering. But there's a real resource emphasis on this, and the potential here is that because we ran out of food, because we were starving, because we were overrun by the tribe from the other side of the hill, we need to take some actions. You know, we need to prepare to hunt. We need to prepare. We need to build a wall around our village. We need to move. But there's this gate has the potential to look time-wise into basically being in the moment, looking back and projecting into the future, or projecting into the near future, I think.
Yep.
And one other aspect about this is people that have this energy are, you know, it's sort of sentry energy. It's beating of the drums. It's not necessarily the organizing of tribal efforts, but it's as Reverend Rick was saying, it's the alerting. This is going on. We need to take a look at this.
Yep. And as we've said before, you know, these energies all kind of play together. So, you know, the returning, as you mentioned before, may not be specifically concerned with food and the acquisition of food, but it does have an element to play into it where returning to the same place over and over again where you were able to find food may actually show up in there. You know, it may actually be expressed that way. And of course, the alertness of the 44 each time lets you know how safe or not it is at that moment, you know, relying on that cellular memory of what happened last time. And I guess that brings us to the last one. Oh, go ahead, Peter.
It does, but before we go there, Reverend Rick had private messaged me about I had a technical glitch in posting the mandala, which is on the blog post. Again, if you joined us late, there's a posting on loveyourhumandesign.com. Click on Peter's blog, and then on the Incarnation Cross of the Four Ways post. And there's a mandala up top that has the cross in it. It had last week's cross in it. I made a technical boo-boo there. And I fixed that. So if you're already on the article, just hit refresh on your browser, and now it should be Oprah Winfrey's, and you can also click on that to get a larger view where you can see a little bit more detail.
Oh, I like hers much better. It's more colorful.
Well, I think you might say that Oprah Winfrey is a bit more colorful than James Wood. Not knocking him, I'm just.
Yep.
Personality-wise.
So we're
down to the wire here, to the 33.
The 33. And I just want to acknowledge, I'm seeing there's a couple of questions or comments out on the chat board, and so I just want to acknowledge that we will get to those in just a moment. Let's just finish up the gate 33. And then we'll, Peter, if you want to go ahead and handle those right afterwards, then we'll do that, okay?
Sounds good. Sounds good.
All right, so gate 33. Gate 33 is an interesting one. Again, looking at the chart, at Oprah Winfrey's chart, there's a white square, the third energy center down from the top, a white square with a little blue circle on the bottom left corner of it, and that is gate 33. That white square represents the throat energy center. The throat center is, as we know, you know, concerned with communication and manifestation and all that. But 33 is an interesting gate because it's on the throat, so you would think it would be more concerned with communication, but it's known as the gate of privacy. So this is an energy that, although it's geared towards communication, it won't tell you anything until it's good and ready to tell you, or until the right kinds of questions have been asked. And so when we look at it from the viewpoint of the movements or the four ways of interactions, this is from the I Ching also called retreat. And so it's an energy where normally you would think of voice gates, you know, gates on the throat, to be very communicative and vocal. This is a gate that is very silent. It enjoys its silence. Now, of course, we've said many times that there's a duality in human design. So even though it is the gate of privacy, even though it is the movement of retreat, of going back, of you know, ending the interaction, if you will, the duality is that, you know, this could just be a voice that tells all, whether you want it to or not. So, you know, you're gonna get both extremes in this kind of gate. So the interaction is going to be either one of the silence of going back to one's village and no longer saying anything, or the image, and of course my mind is always going in a weird direction, but the image I have is one of, you know, two people parting ways as they meet on the street and every so often turning around and waving goodbye at each other. You know, okay, see ya, all right, bye. Or the people who spend 10 minutes on the phone saying goodbye to each other after having a one-hour conversation, they're still saying goodbye after, you know, 10, 15 minutes. So, you know, there's that kind of communicative energy taking place there. So I'm sorry, Peter. My mind was just going in like really weird directions with all of that.
No, it makes sense. And you know, we're looking at Oprah Winfrey's chart, and if you think about her talk show, part of the focus of that was to bring people on so that they could talk about, give them the opportunity or not to voice experiences that we all have shared, but are private. It's a bringing together the expression of commonality, things we've collectively shared,
mm-hmm.
but may not have wanted to share or may have resisted sharing because there's some intimacy, there's some privacy about it.
Yeah. Well, and part of that too, also, Peter, is that you know, the stories that are aired on her show are always about someone else. You know, Oprah Winfrey herself is actually a rather private individual. She's a public figure, but she's a rather private individual. And so her shows are never really about her. It's always somebody else's story, somebody else's experience, you know, somebody else's book. You know, it's very rare that you'll see a story on her show focused on her.
That's true. In fact, she had I want to say it was with Barbara Walters, but I might be wrong on the host. She was interviewed and talked about her relationship and talked about not having her decision not to have children, which was a huge thing for her. And, you know, and there was that. In fact, I didn't even know she had a husband.
Yep.
They've been together for 20-some years. I mean, that's how private she is. I don't know how many of our listeners know that she has a husband and is very close to, but they lead sort of very compartmentalized lives from the public eye,
mm-hmm.
even though she's such a public figure.
Right. And I knew she was married. I did not know for how long. But you're right. I mean, you hear about other couples in the tabloids and in the media and all that kind of stuff all the time. But with Oprah, if you read anything about Oprah, it's always about her. You know, the news story is always focusing on her. Now, not her stories, but other media news stories are always about her. You never hear about her husband, hardly ever. You know, there might have been a few in the last few years or something, but
yep.
you know, for the most part, she has really been able to maintain a privacy. And here we see she's got that energy, that gate that deals with being able to be private.
It, you know, and to take it further, if you look at it, her privacy is in line two, the gate of the hermit. So it's even, I would say that's an emphasis on retreating into that privacy, at least in that aspect of her life.
Yep, absolutely.
So there's one more aspect of this gate, which is it's a interesting dilemma. And I guess dilemma is not the right word for it, but this is a collective energy, and the collective is all about bringing exposure, I guess is a way to say it, of, and this is a gate in sensing, so this is bringing an exposure of experiences. You know, but as we've talked about, it does have this privacy. And one of the things I was thinking about is part of the need for privacy is to maintain the integrity of the experience. And probably, I guess, the best example I can think of off the top of my head would be language. And if you think about the globalization of the world, there are certain languages that are getting lost because they're no longer being taught to the children of that particular area because they've adopted English or in the case of, you know, and this isn't a common this isn't a phenomenon that's common to just right now. It's been going on probably since we've had language, but there's probably a lot of languages that were lost in South America when the Spanish influence came in, and the tribal languages gave way to Spanish. And so where I'm getting at with this gate is there's a need for separation to maintain the integrity, because without the privacy or the separation or your own four walls, as Ra talks about it, then everything starts to get mingled and you lose the uniqueness of that experience, or, you know, in the case of language, the uniqueness of that language, because it becomes either integrated. I've read about the French complaining that it's been, they have a term for it, how American words have crept into French.
Yes, they don't like that very much.
but here, I think that energy is buried in this gate, that it's part of the purpose. I guess another example I could give you, if you go to a support group, you have the potential to share your reason for being there, whether it's a grief group or Alcoholics Anonymous or whatever. You have the ability to share your experience. If you spend a lot of time in that group, you may lose some of the uniqueness of your experience mingled in with all those other experiences that have been shared. And so that energy is within this group, that it's trying to maintain some integrity of the experience and sharing where it's appropriate. Instead of being, let's share everything all the time.
Yeah. And Peter, I think you hit it right there, is when it's appropriate. As a collective energy, the keynote for collective energy is sharing, which means, you know, necessarily this voice out of the throat, even though it's called privacy and has that energy of retreating, either away from others or into oneself, however you want to look at it, it is called upon to share experiences, life experiences, when appropriate, because that's how the collective can move forward. You know, we've been talking about movement, you know, and moving forward and survivability and all that kind of stuff. Well, this is another one of those gates that says we need to be able to move forward, but we need to preserve the uniqueness of this experience so that we can share it when it's necessary, when it's needed, when it's appropriate to get the maximum benefit out of this experience. If that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. And so we haven't really looked at Jerry. Jerry. I don't know if you've seen Seinfeld, but there's a character called Newman, and Jerry's always saying Newman, and Newman's always saying Jerry.
yeah, that's how they meet each other, right?
Yeah. But, you know, I think it's interesting if we look at both Oprah and Jerry together. What are they trying to do? Well, you know, their focus is to share experiences, to help, you know, to basically help us figure out what our needs are. And Jerry does it through comedy and poking fun at things. And Oprah does it by giving opportunities to people to talk about what they're doing, what they've been through, that kind of thing.
And if you look at the gate activation table to the left of the graphic, you know, you'll see that we started with gate 19 in Oprah's chart. That was her lead gate initiated by the sun. And then the earth right below it, on the personality side here is where I'm looking, the earth was activating gate 33, which, Peter, you just said, is that you know, sharing the stories with the collective. So these are the primary energies that are leading the way for her. You know, the other two on the design side, remember, those are energies that are not necessarily, we're not necessarily aware of those expressions until somebody brings it out, you know, until somebody tells us about it. But the personality energies are things that we are consciously aware of. And if we look down at Jerry's, Jerry has it reversed. Jerry's lead energies are 24 and 44 on the personality side, you know, activated by the sun and the earth, respectively. His 19 and 33 are the unaware side. So he's going to be more concerned with that mental returning and that alertness to coming to meet and interacting kind of thing. And when we look at the TV show that he put together a TV show that was all about comedy, granted a little bit heady comedy every now and then, but it was all about his daily adventures, his daily life, his daily interactions, you know, his coming to meet others and departing from them. And that was the primary basis of his show, was just the interactions that took place. And the comedy, of course, was strewn in between all of that. So go ahead.
I was just going to say, in the things he pointed out were common things that keep returning in everybody's life. You know,
yep.
Looking for a parking space, you know, dealing with somebody that insulted you, you know, just very common things.
Yep. So, you know, the way their lead conscious energies, their personality energies, played out into their professional lives, I think is very, very interesting and very telling here.
Yes.
Just a little side note that I wanted to throw out there.
Now that's perfect, and I think as we go through these crosses, it just seems I tend to pick people that are famous just because it gives us a more common language to talk about, because they've had more exposure. We have more of a chance to see what they've done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But we did have, as you pointed out, we do have a couple of questions on the chat site from Susan, and agreed upon by Mike Wehart, if I got that right. I don't know. but the main question there is, with all this terminology, some things make sense, but it gets confusing. And what's the best way to go about it? And for me, I think it's to break it down. And there are pieces in the human design system that you can right away start applying. And, you know, for each person that's different, but as a general guideline, I'd say that the top two are probably, I think understanding your profile is probably my top one, and then second is understanding what your type is. So understanding your profile and how you're going to be driven. You know, are you driven to be private? Are you driven to have experiences? Are you driven towards foundation? Are you driven towards opportunity? Are you a fifth line and projective? Because that will, I think understanding your profile will help you understand sort of a core level of how your personality comes off to others and how you're designed for your personality to be oriented. And then the second one is type and knowing your type and strategy and playing with that. You know, this is, human design is a guide. It's not written in stone how you're gonna play it out. The best example of this is I have a woman that worked for me. She has triplet sons. They were all born within 3 minutes of each other. They all have the exact same chart, but they're all very different people. And she was trying to get her head around that. Well, how can they have the same chart and be very different people? And the answer is because they're all still going to live out their energy in the way that they choose to. This is, in Reverend Rick's, in my view, this is a system of choice. That doesn't mean you weren't dealt a hand of cards, and that's your chart. And you're going to play the game, and there are some rules to the game, unless you invent your own game. but the way you play those cards is up to you.
Mm-hmm.
Reverend Rick,
and I might add something to that, Peter. You know, I might add, although we don't record birth times to the second, but there, you know, for the times that there are calculations that actually go down even further, which would show differences in all three of those triplets charts. And, you know, although we don't, like I said, in hospitals and stuff, we don't necessarily go that far into detail, but those details would actually have an impact and help understand how people who look alike and have the same charts and all that kind of stuff could still grow up to be completely different individuals with different likes and different dislikes and different desires and all that kind of stuff. And it's not about how homogeneous we are. It's about, like you said, what choices do we make along the way to exercise these energetic expressions? Because there's always that choice. You know, which way do you want to utilize this energy? And, you know, I know that's probably a point of contention with different people, but you and I have agreed before that, you know, we believe we do have the choice as to how we will allow that energy to get expressed through us. You know, there's all kinds of different things that could play into it, and, you know, I guess as things unfold, we'll learn more. But one of the, and I totally agree with you, Peter, in terms of probably the two most important things for people to understand about their charts, especially in the beginning, especially when they're first getting to know about it, is that that type and that profile. You know, what are the primary energies that you're designed with, you know, that you were born into the world with, and how you were meant to impact the world and be impacted by the world. You know, getting a handle on all of that is primary, but it is primary. As you and I both know, Peter, we can go into so many levels of detail in looking at a person's chart. I mean, we could talk to somebody about his or her chart for several hours at a time and still only be, you know, hitting superficially on a lot of different areas. So what I would recommend to people is start with that overview. Start with that primer of profile and type, you know, profile, type, and strategy, I guess. Start with that, and if you really want to apply that to your life, as you said, Peter, have fun with it. Play with it. You know, apply it sometimes and don't apply it others, and see what happens and see what the difference is and see how people respond and react with you. And then Peter, you and I may differ on this, I don't know, but I'm going to throw it out there as this. I would say, you know, for at least a month or so, go out there and actively play with that information and then decide, okay, am I ready for the next step? Am I ready for the next level? You know, but give yourself that playtime first rather than just diving into it right away. And because there is another level, and Peter, you and I both offer foundational readings that go into a deeper level, but then again, you know, as I said, it's not going to cover everything because we just can't physically do that in one, you know, in one session or even in a few short sessions. So applying the information in one's design to one's life, I think takes, to bring us back to the cross, it takes a returning. It takes a constant returning to that information and learning a little bit more. You know, as we grow into the knowledge, as we grow into the ability to understand more and more about our design, it becomes clearer. But until it becomes something that is taught, I guess, as a standard in schools, you know, and I hope one day that it does get to that level. But until that happens, I guess we're just going to need to be open to receiving the next piece of information when we're ready for it. And I, as a former teacher, I honestly believe if you're not ready for it, there's no point in trying to get it because it's just not going to make sense. But when you are ready for it and you know you're ready for it, say, okay, I'm ready for the next step. What's next? Your thoughts on that, Peter?
No, I think that's so true, and it sort of leads into something that is on my development list, and that is to develop an email course on specific to your design that essentially breaks down and spoon feeds you your design in little bits and chunks. So as you are learning, you can, you know, try to integrate the different pieces.
Yep.
That come up. And looking at, Susan had pointed out that she had manifesting energy, and so I happened to pull up her chart because I'd run it. And, you know, so using that as an example, you're a manifesting generator, so, you know, what you should be playing with is how you're informing people, how you're responding, you know, what level of responding and interaction work for you and what doesn't. And Susan only has the sacral, spleen, and throat defined, so there's a lot of openness in your chart. And I'd say after, and she's a 6-3, so going back to the profile, understanding that you are here to experiment and experience life. And that's the way you're going to learn, always, is through experience and experiment. And, you know, and then the next level on that is sifting through the opportunities to experiment and deciding which are yours and which aren't. Which are, with six open centers, there's a large potential for people introducing their experiments to you and you taking them on. And again, there's no right or wrong here. So it becomes an exercise or a game of, you know, which experiments are yours, which experiments are for others, or more for others, but you're going to take on because you want to be part of that. And which are there for you to just leave because they're not really yours. They're somebody else's. You know, then on top of that, with six open centers, there's strategy around all the open centers. And, you know, so adding bits and pieces there. Strategy for an open head, strategy for an undefined root, strategy for an open solar plexus. They all have strategies, and as Reverend Rick was saying, you know, the foundational reading is a great way to get started to a deeper level, because in those readings we can give you some of those strategies. We can talk about it specifically about experiences, decisions, issues that are in your life, and how to form strategy around that to play with your design, to work with that so you come to a deeper understanding of you. Anything else you want to add, Reverend Rick? I see you've been busy on the chat board.
Yeah, just adding, trying to answer a couple of questions there. And the next question that came up was, what do the red and the black mean in terms of the lines on the connecting the energy centers? So, and we've talked about that before in terms of, you know, red basically is the design energy. Those are the gates. If you look at the table to the left of the graphic, the gates activated in the red column, those are gates whose energetic expressions may or may not be known to you. You know, generally we tend to be more unaware of those expressions until somebody points it out. Meanwhile, the gates activated on the black column, we call that the personality, because those are energetic expressions that we are primarily aware of and recognize in ourselves. And those gates, whether they're activated in the red or the black columns, are represented by the red and black lines in the graphic between the energy centers. And if a gate happens to be activated on both sides, the red and the black, then it shows up as a checkered pattern in the graphic. And that's all the correlation is there between the red and black. It's just so that you can see exactly where in the list it's activated. It lets you know if it's a design energy or a personality energy or both. And the red numbers, the design numbers, come from, well, Peter, I'll let you take that one. The design activations take place when and where and why?
The design activations, well, the personality activations take place at the moment of birth. So whenever you exit the womb, again, often get the question, you know, whether it's natural birth, a C-section. When you exit the body of your mother, that is when you get your personality or your conscious design. And the design comes from 88 degrees, when the planets are 88 degrees before birth, which is approximately 88 days. And, excuse me, that is a part of the mathematical formula that's used in human design, and
right.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but that's also a a fraction of the human gestation process. Is that where that comes from, Reverend Rick?
It necessarily is a fraction of it, a little less than a third of it, I guess, but I'm not really sure what the actual calculation is. I am aware that it is, the design numbers do come from 88 degrees of the sun. That's just a brief correction there, Peter. You had said of the planets earlier. 88 degrees of the sun prior to birth, which does translate to roughly 88 days. Many times you'll hear people just say, oh, yeah, well, 3 months before birth. You know, but the actual correct calculation is 88 degrees of the sun prior to birth is when the design gates are activated. But I don't actually know the full formula. I've often wondered about it, but since I don't know that much about astrology, I wasn't sure if I would even be able to understand that formula.
Yeah, I thought it obviously it's a fraction. It has to be a fraction of the... I thought there was a formula that it was, well, not divided by a third, but in the degrees, it was a certain percentage. But, you know, and this is not, should point out to our listeners, this is not the only way that human design is done. There is another system by a woman named Eleanor Haspel Portner, Unified Life Sciences. And in her version of this system, she looks at it 8 times. She looks at 88 minutes before and after birth, 88 degrees before and after birth, and whatever the number is for 9 months, because it's not actually 9 months. I believe the human gestation is like 9.5 months, but it's typically called 9 months because most women don't know they're pregnant until 2 weeks later. So it's built on those calculations, and so she comes up with multiple charts and then a synthesis. And in some degrees, it's similar to the human design system or the human design chart you have. In other instances, it may be different. Reverend Rick and I are sort of the school of that probably is a more accurate system, but for us, the complexity of human design is enough of a challenge, and to add that many more charts on top of that, I guess where we're at now is we don't feel people, it's just too much to try to handle. I felt like it was too much for me to fully understand. So I'd have a hard time teaching it to others.
Yeah, and actually I would even say that, you know, one of the things that I like about human design is its simplicity, not really its complexity. There is a lot of deepness to it. I wouldn't say that it's complex, but there's a lot of deepness. You know, the further you go in levels, you know, the deeper you go into the levels, the more detailed you'll get in the information. But it's not that it's complex information. If you structure it properly, you can see there are 9 energy centers. Their expressions are broken down into the gates that they contain, and those gates' expressions are further broken down into the 6 lines into which they're activated. And if they happen to match up with a corresponding gate in another energy center, then there's a channel connection being made, which adds another element to it. But there's a simplicity in the way it all ties together that, you know, from my perspective, the more complicated we make things, the further we are from the truth. And because truth is simple. You know, I mean, it's just there. You know, truth is simple. And the more complex we make it, the more we overthink things. And I don't want to say that to take away from any of the work that Eleanor's doing, because personally, I find it absolutely fascinating. And yes, it is much more complex, But at the same time, if you're into, she's pretty much a scientist. You know, she likes to do statistical studies of things, and so all of her work is based in science, and it is absolutely fascinating to look into. And I really, really highly recommend anyone who's serious about looking into human design from a scientific point of view. You know, I seriously recommend checking her out because she's done a great deal of work in that regard. But like Peter, you know, when it comes to the work that we do with it, you know, I think simpler the better. You know, the simpler the better. And once, again, as we said before, once you get to, you know, once you get to the point where you're ready for the more complex stuff, then Eleanor would be the one to talk to.
Well, Reverend Rick, anything else before we call it a day?
I think I'm just going to retreat into my abode and return to the tasks that call me from day to day. So, so I think we're good.
All right.
You want to mention briefly what's coming up next Tuesday?
Next Tuesday, I know Barb has a guest, but I don't know her name, on Spiritual Help Desk on Blog Talk Radio.
Is that Pam Gerund? Is she next week? Or
yes.
Is that...
Yes, that's correct. That's correct. So that's next Tuesday on Spiritual Help Desk at 1 p.m. Next Thursday, our tentative plan is to do another incarnation cross. The cross that we'll be in is the cross of the Sphinx. And so... We will be diving back into that. We did that once before. We looked at the gates, but I think we're going to go into a deeper level of that. So that's next Thursday at 1. So we hope you'll join us for either one of those.
Cool beans. Looking forward to that one.
Well, thank you for joining us on Human Design on Air. We hope you have a great week and can join us again.
Night, everyone.